he's that I was telling about that had the tall, very tall wife, had a tall son. Oh, he was 6'4" or something like that, and he and Pearl used to go hunting together, and it was quite a sight to see them walking up across the field, you know. And this Gardner Hayes was real thin but tall, and seems they went bear hunting, and Gardner left Pearl to guard this runway where he thought the bear might come, and they'd seen a bear track, and so Gardner took off on the bear track, and he left Pearl in this particular spot, and he jumped, they call it jumping the bear, when he jumped up and ran, and he put the bear right back through there, right through that place where he had left his father. And of course he was pretty disgusted his father wasn't there, and so he walked around the hill, and his father had left and gone to another place, and he said, Dad, why did you leave that runway down there? Well, but Jesus Christ, Pearl says, I thought I would go over on the other side of the hill. Yes, Gardner says, God damn it, you're always going on the other side of the hill. I guess I'd like to tell about horse racing in those days. People didn't have automobiles, but they usually had a driving horse besides their working team. And some of them had some pretty good ones. And I can remember my father telling on Saturday nights over in Lincoln that the boys would go to Bristol and race horses down on Bristol Flats, they call it, and have some quite exciting times. Well, my mother was quite a person for animals. She loved animals, and she so they had raised this colt that they called Charlie, and they'd raised him from a baby, and broke him and used him, and he weighed about 1,200 or 1,250. And in those days, John Mobus ran the what they call the creamery down in Warren Village, and you took your milk down there, and they separated it, and you could have your skim milk back, but they used the cream to make butter there and sold it. And so it was my mother's job to take that milk down each morning, and she said she had this big, heavy buckboard and two of those big cans of milk in there, in that buckboard. And she got, as you go down the road from their place, a little over a mile, there's the place that, somebody lived there, I can't think of his last name, but he pulled out of his driveway just ahead of my mother. And they were visiting, going along down the road, and they got down to the corner where you turned to go to Warren Village, or you could go ahead up to Fred Ellie's. And here was Frank Lamb coming down with his little mare. And she was a real pretty little thing. And when he was making that turn, he was making it to go ahead of the other two towards the village. And he's Frank Lamb says, I tell you, Abe Van Dusen, that was his name. He said, I tell you, Abe, if you have a horse that weighs over 1,000, you haven't got anything that can travel at all. He says, they're all right to work, but they can't travel. Well, you might as well have slapped my mother in the face, you know, because she thought her horse was wonderful. And she said, you let me go ahead, Mr. Lamb, and follow me at the village this morning, and I'll show you whether I've got any good horse or not. But he didn't wait for her to show him. He put the whip on his little mare, and he started down the road. Of course, the road wasn't very wide, you know, in those days. And she tagged him. And he was, every little while, he'd hit his horse on the butt a little bit with that whip, and he was getting all that he could out of her. She was just, and my mother, all she was doing was hanging onto this Charlie horse and saying, "Whoo boy, whoo boy." And she put her front wheel right in back of Frank Clam's back wheel. And she says, "I pulled just as hard as, I let him go just as hard as I dared to on that." She says, "I was afraid he'd break one of our wheels." And she says, and Frank wouldn't give her room to go by. He just wouldn't let her by. And she tagged him all the way to the village like that. And just holler. And every little way she'd say, "Whoo, Charlie, whoo, Charlie." And he was just a legging it right down there. You know, he could have gone by that other horse like nothing. And when they came up to the creamery, that way, right up the street, and the men that were standing on the steps there grabbed those two milk cans and put them right over on the porch to the creamery, and she looked at them for just a minute, and she said, "Frank Lamb disappeared." And she said, "I waited around for him for half, three quarters of an hour, but he never showed. Said I was going to show him the way home too."
That's a wonderful story.
I think that shows, people didn't, like I said, didn't have automobiles and they didn't have a lot of things, but they had their horses that they were real proud of. Everyone had a nice horse and they were real proud of their own horse and the things that. And I remember that same horse. They heard noises in the barn two nights, and they went down there, and that horse had been harnessed, but he didn't have the bridle on one night, and another night he was just didn't have anything on him, but he was loose. Somebody had unhitched him, and they thought it was someone was going to steal him, and they thought it was my mother's brother, Gabe, that was doing all this, because he was never up to any good. He had stolen from them in other ways, so they kind of figured that maybe it was him that was trying to steal that horse, because he was such a good one, he could get, you know, quite a lot of money. And so they sold the horse, and they sold him to Mr. Farr down just this side. He lived on that farm just this side of Hancock Village on the left as you're going down. And my father and Gabe went down there one day. I don't know why I wouldn't have gone with Gabe if I thought that he had was trying to steal from me, but he did. He went with him, and Gabe used to go down there quite often to Hancock and get liquor by liquor, and my father went along, and they stopped to Farr's to see that horse, and Mr. Farr said to my father, he said, "I understand that you can plant corn with that horse and not have anybody drive him or ride him or do it, that he'll follow that marker that the corn planter leaves." And my father said, "Yes, he will." And he said, "Could I hire you to plant that piece of corn with him this afternoon?" And my father, of course, was glad to do it, because he wanted to be with the horse. And so he planted his piece of corn and never made a step, never made a miss anywhere. That horse just towed that mark right back and forth without anyone doing anything with him. You know, and people were proud of their horses. You know, they had taught them to do things that, and so on. Well, this Frank Lamb lived up where my wife and I lived. We called it the Maynard Place, and now I guess they call it the Gove Place, because we lived there 18 years. But John Roth lives there now on that farm. And Justin Tucker lived there at that time, and he had married Frank Lamb's daughter. And Frank, they built another addition on the back side of the house for Mr. Lamb and his wife to live. But he and Justin Tucker never got along very well. And it seems that one morning, Frank went to church every morning, every Sunday, but he, I don't think he ever took the Tuckers with him. You see, there wasn't room for only one in besides him in that buggy, really. And but anyway, he and Justin Tucker, Frank Lamb and Justin Tucker, had some words and Mr. Lamb had come out to the barn. He had harnessed his horse, getting ready for church, and he went and changed his clothes, and he came out with his good suit on and all, and he and Justin Tucker had some words about something, and Justin grabbed Mr. Lamb and threw him over in the pig pen with his good clothes on, and it wasn't too long after that before town meeting came along, and this story had gotten out, and the people of the town of Warren knew that Justin had thrown him over in the pig pen and got him all dirty and so forth, and during the course of town meeting, they asked for nominations for school director, and somebody nominated Justin Tucker. And just as soon as they nominated him, Frank Lamb jumped right up on his feet, and he says, "I think that Justin is the ideal man for the spot." And he said that they said that everybody just hooted and hollered in that whole town hall about that, because they knew what had gone on between them.
Now, just to put all this in a framework, how would you describe Warren and East Warren in this time frame we're talking about?
How would I describe Warren and East Warren? Well, to give you a little bit of an example about it, about the time that I started, at the time that I started first grade, there were fewer children to go to the South School, which is over my way, than there were over at the corner. And so they closed our South School to save money for the town and put us all over to the corner school and had one teacher over there. And of course the people in Southeast Warren, which is where I lived, the Laros and my family and Casey Jones and the Cathans and Ralph Buzzle and all those and the Blairs, you know, they were all pretty mad. They were pretty mad about that, and they didn't have a good thing to say, and it came up in town meeting. I mean, these kind of things came up in town meeting, and they would tell each other what they thought of it, you know. And but I remember Will Trask took us with a pair of mules to school and back again, and which I never ridden after mules before, and I thought that was something. Well, anyway, as I remember, we went over there one year, the year I was in the first grade, and then several of the kids that were in the corner school graduated from the eighth grade that year, and so it made that district less than the South District, and they didn't want that school to go back south, boy, and then the people over there were mad as wet hens, you know, about it. But they put the school back to the south, over south, but the Tuckers wouldn't let Ransom come over there to go to school. His grandfather, Frank Lamb, took him to the village school with that little white-faced mare that I was telling you about and went and got him each night. And well, you know, there wasn't a lot of time for deep feelings, I don't think, you didn't get to know the people down street too well. You know, I remember them having, in East Warren, I remember them having these parties on Saturday nights where they would have a violin, a piano play, and the young people would dance and the older people would play cards. But it was pretty much confined to East Hill. I mean, the people in the other part of the town didn't come. You only saw them if you happened to be down the street and they came down for groceries or grain or something, and you were there, you would see them, and you knew who they were, and you would pass the time of day with them, but you never went from your part of the town over to call on them. You had your own little district up in East Warren, and that's where you stayed and most of the time. I mean, so, but that thing about the school did come up, and everybody was pretty well head up about that. It was Up to how the community reacted. Of course, when I was growing up, there were four boys in my school, but they were 4 years younger than I was there in East Warren. Rupert Blair and my nephew Ward Buzzell and Warren Mobus and Lester Senor. But they were 4 years younger than I was, and they didn't care a snap about playing ball. Now, I had heard about my brothers and seen them play ball, my two older brothers, and they were good ball players, and I was just crazy to learn how to play ball, but nobody in that school wanted to play. It was some younger boys than that even, but the ones that were my age were girls, and they didn't care anything about playing baseball. And so we had a 4-H club. Someone started a 4-H club, and I joined. And that was quite an outing for me because I got to see some of the boys in the other part of the town that I hadn't known at all. And but I couldn't play baseball. I mean, I had never had a chance, you see. And I remember we had a baseball game somewhere. And, of course, the Irish boys, there were three of them there at home, and they could play ball, and they were good at it. But we had this ball game, and anyway, I was in the outfield and trying to play outfield, and this fly ball came out to me, and I didn't get within several feet of it, you know. I just didn't know how. And I remember that Ed Irish's grandfather was coming walking along, because they always went to the games, our high school games later. You'd see them there always, no matter whether it was in crop time or when it was, they were at that ball game. And Mr. Irish came along, and as I said, he had quite a German brogue, and I had just missed that ball. And he came along and he looked at me and he said, "You goddamn fool, you don't know enough to play baseball, do ya? You goddamn fool." I've thought about it a lot since. But when I did get in high school, I worked real hard at learning to play baseball, and I got pretty good at it before I got around to graduate.
Finally. Yeah, I think you were very good.
Well, I was a fast runner, and I played outfield, and I could. It was hard to get a ball out there that I couldn't get, really.
And I none of your brothers played? Yeah.
Yes, my brother.
But they were that older. Much older.
They were older, you see, and they didn't go to high school. Two of my sisters started high school, but they weren't too interested in finishing, I guess. I knew more about these people that I, like I told you about Fremont Lovett, and you know, there were a lot of people that did a lot of good things up that way during my lifetime, and people that I respected, and I wish I knew more of the good things that they did instead of just the funny things that happened to them.
Well, it was an amazing community, I think, from everything I've heard.
You think it was different, huh?
Well, pretty amazing. Outstanding people. A tight-knit community, a lot of fun,
yeah.
A lot of hard work,
yeah.
But, gosh, some outstanding people came out of it.
And I want to tell you, there's another person that I would like to talk a little bit about, and that was Fred Elliott. And he owned that farm up to the corner. They call it the corner. That's where you go over Roxbury Mountain now. That and the DeFries now have torn down his barn that he built and have built a freestall barn right there. So that was Fred Elliott's place. And he was one of the up-and-coming people of the farmers, really, in Warren. He had a little farm just beyond my parents out to Blueberry Lake. And being Fred Elliott, of course, he was in a lot of things. He was select man of the town for a long time, and he was a trustee of Northfield Savings Bank in Northfield. And he was a lot of things. And he bred mares, and he raised some of his teams that he used. And he always had the nicest looking teams that you could ever ask to see. And he had Holstein cattle, and he built onto his barn, and several feet more on the lower end of his barn, and put his barn down in the basement. And he really did a lot of things. And I was saying that he raised potatoes up on that little place above my folks. And I would guess that he probably raised 3 or 4 acres of potatoes. And he had a potato digger. And when it would come potato digging time, he would get my brother Raymond and I, and usually Ernest Brooks would come and help. And we three would pick up potatoes for him. And I'll tell you, you start 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and you pick up potatoes steady until 4 o'clock, and it's a lot of backbending. It's a lot of backbending, but I didn't mind it in those days, and neither did the two older fellows that helped pick up. But anyway, Fred had made up his mind, I guess, that I was someone that would work hard. And so when I got married, my father-in-law had just died a short time after we got married, and I went there on that little place and built the barn over, and I finally got so that I could tie 13 cows in that stable, and I milked them by hand, and I had a pair of horses, and then I bought the Murray place up above. And I was down at the store one morning, and Fred Elliott came in, and he was dressed up, and he said, how is farming going? And I said, well, I don't know. I'm not getting rich. And he says, no. He says, the kind of setup that you have, you haven't really got a chance to do much. He said, the Maynards up in East Warren are moving to Moortown. They bought a farm down there, and they have two farms in East Warren that are for sale, the place where they lived and the place over across that they call the Dannels place. And he said either one of those farms can be bought for $6,500. Of course, the Ralph Maynard place wasn't near as big as the Dannels place, but the buildings were in better shape. That Dannels house was... Well, you could see right through. The cellar wall had fallen into the cellar, and you could look right through. And it was, and the barn was not in very good shape, and it was a large barn over there, whereas the buildings up at the Maynard place was pretty good. And he said, so Fred says, if you had one of those farms, you could go ahead and do something like you're trying to. And I said, well, it's not much use of thinking about that, Fred, because I don't have any money behind me. I don't have a cent above expenses here that we're trying to get by. And he said, if I could speak to the people over at Northfield Bank and you could buy that farm without any money down, would you be interested? And I said, yes, I sure would. And he said, why don't you hop in this car with me right now? I'm going to Northfield to a bank meeting. And when we get over there, you can tell them what you are doing, what you'd like to do. And he says, I will say that I think it's a good thing to loan you the money. And I went with Fred Elliott, and they loaned me the money to buy that farm, and I didn't have a cent.
That's terrific.
To do with. Now, that's what I mean by neighbors helping neighbors. Fred Elliott knew that I was, or at least he thought that I was an honest fellow and a good worker and would make someone that could go up on that farm and do something, and I did.
How long did it take you to turn it around?
To turn it around? Well, I farmed up there for 18 years, and we had the sugar place that we tapped 2,300 maples, and I had cows that I started in and got registered Guernsey cows going there, and I plowed up a piece 4 or 5 acres each spring of new land, and as I did, I would get a bulldozer in and take those stones all off, and by the time I left that farm, I had cleared it of stones. They were all put aside over on the stone walls, and I had I'd done lots of things up there. I really worked hard, and I can remember working in that sugar place until it was dark at night, and then taking my horses and going to the barn, gathering sap, I mean, and then going to the barn and putting my team up and watering my cows, turning all my cattle out to drink, and putting them back and giving them their grain, and then going to the house and having my supper, and then going back and milking those cows. Of course, I had machines, milking machines, but even so, I would be milking, doing chores out there till 9 o'clock, and I would be up again at 6 o'clock the next morning and starting them. I loved working on the land. I loved working with the horses and the cattle.
How come you left there and came down here?
I left there because I had my second son had always wanted to. He'd always tagged me around when we were farming, and he liked the machinery. And as soon as he got big enough, he was on the machinery, working it with it. And he was quite a help. Not that the other boys helped too, but he was the biggest help because he would duff right into it. And he wanted to farm and. So I bought the Albert Neal farm at that time, which was over across from that on the same side of the mountain. You had to go down around the road to go over. We could drive the cattle across, but we had to go across Fred Mobus's land to do it. And so he went, after high school, he went to Randolph Center School. And he graduated over there, and he met a girl over there and got married. And so I bought this Albert Neal place so that he'd have a place to live. And I had changed my milk house all over, built a new milk house, in fact, and put in a bulk tank and put my stable down in the basement. And I had really gone to a lot of expense and work. And he farmed for about a year, and I guess his wife decided they didn't want to farm, so he left. And I was left with 630 acres of land. And all that I had built up for him, and so I just was discouraged, and I sold out and came to Moortown to a smaller farm that I... And I guess it was the worst move that I had ever made in my life, because if I'd stayed there, just stayed there and sold off part of my cattle and just coasted along in another 7 or 8 or 10 years at least, I would have been able to sell that for $2,000 and $3,000 an acre, that land. But I was discouraged, and I just gave up and came to Moortown. And well, that was how I happened to leave Warren.
Because your soul seems to be in Warren.
Yeah, I like it here in Moortown. There's an awful lot of nice people here. Of course, I don't know anything about the things that went on in Moortown, but I'm amazed to hear some of the stories. They have stories, you know, like I do about the Warren people. And I remember Cedric Reagan telling me this stories, and he told who the people were, but of course they didn't mean anything to me because I never knew them. These two couples sort of played cards in the evening together and whatnot, and first you knew they had traded wives, and one wife went to live with the other guy, and they tried that out a while and made up their mind they wanted to stay that way. So one farmer gave the other one a pig to boot between wives. Gave him a fat pig to boot.
That's one wife was supposed to be
better. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Yeah, he felt.
Oh, that's funny. And then he spoke about, I think it was the first ward that came. He arrived in Moortown.
Yeah. Burton. Burton Ward arrived in Moortown, they tell me, with his ox team and a bobsled and his chains, axe, and saws. And that's all he had to his name when he came to Moortown. And by the time that Merlin at least died down here, one of his sons, by the time the last son died in Moortown, they said that you could go down on Bolton Flats and go up on that mountain in Bolton and not get off Moore Lumber Company's land until you got to Faiston. All over those mountains was all Ward Lumber Company's land, and they had three mills here in town, and they did quite a business.
It's amazing.
I like to tell a little story about Marion Barton's father. He lived in They lived in St. Albans, or Georgia, just the site of St. Albans. And one day this man came up to her father, to Mr. Conger, and said, do you know Jed Sweeney? Are you acquainted with Jed Sweeney? And Mr. Conger said, yes, I know Jed Sweeney. And this was a fellow that had moved down into the state from Canada. They came down, a lot of them came down and were farmers up that way from Canada. And this fellow said, you know Jed Sweeney? Yes, I know Jed Sweeney. And the man says, he was kind of a French fellow, and he says, he's the father of my oldest boy. And he said, her father should have told me about that, but he didn't. He said, oh, well, I probably married it anyway. Operator?
Well, the one you told last time about taking out the telephone.
Oh. Dark Nealon lived up in Faiston. Uh-huh. And he was a kind of a rough-talking man, and he called up one of his neighbors, and they talked kind of rough, and Dark did some swearing, and the conversation went on for quite a long while. And finally, this operator down at Waitsfield, which was Stella Newton, a lady that I knew when I was in high school there in Waitsfield, broke in on the conversation and said, Mr. Nealon, I'd like to have you hang up now because there are other people that want to use that line. And